Hello and welcome to the Covenant of Mayors podcast, unlocking insights into how cities can adapt to climate change throughout Europe. I'm Anthony Coakley, and today I'll be speaking to Alexandra Pommartin, postdoctoral researcher from the University of Girona and the Autonomous University of Barcelona. She's an expert in environmental justice and the social and political implications of nature-based solutions on water, food, and energy. As a contributor to the European Edible Cities Network, her research enables urban food innovations and sustainable urban planning to make cities greener, more edible, and livable. For the Covenant of Mayors Policy Support Facility on Climate Adaptation, she made a great contribution on the topic of just resilience. In part one of today's podcast, we'll try to understand what people mean by just resilience. And in the second part, we'll dive into some real-life dilemmas and speak about practical ways to overcome them. Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation. Pleasure to be here.
So, Alexandra, for our listeners, what do you mean by resilient cities? And what does resilience have to do with climate change?
The simple way to refer to resilience is the capacity of a system to resist an impact, a negative impact, and ideally to bounce back. So the concept of resilience also implies that you also recuperate to a previous state, and hopefully sometimes the fact that the impact changes your current state sometimes also offers the opportunity for improvement, but that's perhaps too much to expect. So many times at least we expect to, let's say, go back to the previous state. The relation to climate change is obvious in the sense that it is one of the challenges of our societies. It's probably one of the most important nowadays, and there is greater and greater acknowledgement across the world, but also across policies, that this impact is something that we have to cope with, and that it is greater and greater as, let's say, in time, we expect that this impact of the climate change, and again, across different countries and across different sectors, will increase. And therefore, we need as a society to build in this resilience, right? And this is a complex task, right? Because it involves not only technology, and we tend to think about environment, and we have been thinking about the environment of how, in terms of, you know, designing better technologies to treat water better, to, you know, imagine building seawalls for increased sea levels. But at the same time, actually, there is a greater acknowledgement or awareness across society that we also have to build our communities stronger in order to cope with climate change.
From what you've initially said, it would seem to me that the idea of justice is somehow inherent in resilience. So can you tell me about just resilience? Would it be possible to have a variety of resilience or true resilience that was unjust?
It is important to remember that when we talk about resilience and justice, one thing that is fundamental is that climate change, and in general, environmental degradation that comes with climate change, right? It has to do with exhaustion of resources, of disappearance of biodiversity. So everything that comes along with climate change will not impact everybody in the same way. So that is something that we know. And you see how this, you know, is connected to the idea of justice. In what way? Well, climate change in many cases will accelerate or will deepen vulnerabilities that are already present in our system globally and in each country. You know? So we are a fundamentally unequal society. A phenomenon like climate change is known to accelerate or to deepen this inequality. You know, as I said before, what kind of inequalities are we talking about? We're talking about gender, race, poverty, so class, if you want. These are, the vectors on which climate change will impact unequally across society. And therefore, it is fundamental that when we adapt to deal with climate change, we take into consideration this unequal impact on vulnerable communities or groups of people. When we design policies against climate change, to adapt to climate change, these policies themselves can create more vulnerability, right? So we can take measures which are called maladaptation. So adaptation that actually protects some populations, right, on the riverbanks, for instance, you would relocate them, but at the same time, you would create more inequality in another place because you would have more competition for resources. And there are many, many, many examples that we can give there. So to summarize, we have these two dimensions: how we adapt take into consideration vulnerability and how this adaptation does not create more vulnerability. This would be serving the concept of just resilience.
So there's a sense in which resilience is inherently just because those that suffer from climate change, the vulnerable suffer more, and therefore tackling climate change creates justice. But there's also a fear that we could tackle climate change in a way that might, I think you don't maybe want to say solve the problem, but somehow mitigate the effects on certain parts of society, but still make those that are suffering most worse off or equally poorly off. Is that right?
Yes. And not only that, so I think it's very important to take a global perspective, because yes, you say, okay, we are becoming more resilient and therefore we should dismiss that we are protecting everybody, but we are not going to protect everybody in the same way. Climate change is associated to CO2 emissions, right? Okay, so what we have to do is to curb the emission of CO2. And we know per different sectors, which are the different, that we know that not all sectors contribute in the same way, but let's say transport is one of those important contributors to that. So what do we do about transport? But let's say electrical vehicles would be a way out of that.
Sure.
That would be a good solution. Now, what happens with electrical vehicles? We have been very good in the global north to shift, to become more resilient ourselves, or to defend ourselves, or to take measures that protect us, while at the same time we shift the burden of our measures to other places in the world. Other places in the world which already are impacted by entrenched processes of colonization, etc. So they have been suffering already from a long-term impact of, let's say, this south and north differences in equality. Going back to electrical vehicles, what happens? Well, to build electrical vehicles, yeah, we know we need fundamentally not only electrical vehicles, but powerful and vehicles that go a long way without having to charge them, etc. So we need these batteries that are made of lithium, fundamentally in cobalt. Now, where does cobalt come from? The largest reserves of cobalt in the world is Congo, and cobalt is extracted with slave labor and creating immense heart-wrenching suffering to people in these countries, in these mines. And this is just one example. And we know now we have perhaps on about 25 million electric vehicles on the streets. And in order to reach what the Paris Accord is aiming at, which is to stay below the 1.5 degree overall heating, we would need 10 times more that number of vehicles on the streets, of electrical vehicles. So you see where I'm going. In order to deal with carbon emissions, we have to find ways in the global north, which is where development and most consumption is concentrated. But we need to extract those basic materials for our development for places where this extraction creates suffering, enormous suffering, and in a way, our system, our economic system, is based, which has a name, it's a capitalist system, it needs this cheap labor and this inequality and therefore this unjust situation, because we talk about injustice. I think this is a very good example, I think, of how it is impossible to consider resilience and adaptation to climate change in a just way without considering a global perspective. We have to discuss also social sustainability, and therefore it is an unsustainable way to deal with resilience if we don't consider the harm we are shifting somewhere else. And the same happens also with other sectors.
I think we're all aware to a degree, even if we don't put it at the front of our minds, of these issues with mining, especially cobalt in the Congo. But I saw from what you had sent also something which had never occurred to me, which is that the waste, the heavy metals, also end up in the ground among these less fortunate societies, right?
It's interesting because we think about shifting waste to African countries that are poor. I know, for instance, Cameroon is one of the places where we dump our electronic waste, etc. But this also happens, or used to happen, at European level. Europe itself is a location of inequality, geographical inequality, because we think about North and South, but also East and West is another divide. And to give you an example in this sense, Albania, there has been protest there because we are shifting, they are a place of shifting waste from Western Europe. And at the same time, they are unable to recycle their own waste. So the Albania recycles something towards 25% of its own waste, which is actually not bad considering, but there is an enormous amount of waste that they are unable to process themselves. And on top of that, they have to receive, let's say, our. It's strange because I've been living in Spain for 20 years, but I'm Romanian myself. And sometimes I'm not always sure what is the hour, right? Because let's say in this time, I imagine myself I'd be hours from the Eastern Europe, no? So I'm pretty connected to this legacy and to this the problems that let's say climate change is creating in this part of the Europe, and that's why I wanted to give you this example.
There's also within European countries in the West these deep inequalities between different regions and cities.
Oh yes.
And areas within cities. Now, we're speaking through the Covenant of Mayors at the moment, and we have tons of case studies, many of which I've worked on through Eurocities, on electric vehicle sharing and electric bus fleets. And so would you say that we should go back into the archives and scrap all those case studies and just tell the cities don't do electric because it's got these bad inputs and bad outputs? Or would you say that there's another way that we could, how do we deal practically, or what kind of approach are you recommending for cities when it comes to systems like this that have maybe not inherent, but certainly ongoing issues at both ends of the supply chain?
It's a natural question. When one deals with issues of environmental justice, and you see there is when adaptation or in general environmental interventions or policies produce this incredible suffering in other parts of the world, it was okay, what can we do about this? Because we know, electrical vehicles are supposed to be this silver bullet in many ways, and if you could just put our tunnel vision and just look at our societies and just look away. One way to deal with it is just look away. And we've been pretty good at doing this in Europe, haven't we? And not only Europe, in the global north. I definitely don't have the way out of the dilemma, but this is where definitely technology can help. Though if you read this beautiful book by Siddharth Kara, this is called Cobalt Red, the blood that feeds our lives, that powers our lives. He says there that there is no such thing as clean cobalt, right? Problem. It's lithium that is mined industrially, but what he says is that in fact there is. It's not true that the industrial mining in fact is plagued with artisanal mining, and there's no way you can separate in the supply chain where these metals actually come from. If they come from blood, cobalt, or lithium. So going back to solutions, you were asking me about this. Awareness is one way to definitely go about to start to deal with the issue, to know that our lifestyles are intimately related to this heart-wrenching suffering in around the world. And in terms of electric vehicles, well, I do believe it is important to start investing in technology. So again, if we are aware that this is a problem, so we take this moral stance to our lifestyles, then there is a greater opportunity to invest in technologies or to search for these technologies that are cleaner, and also consider restoration. So technologies to find better materials to replace this cobalt, but also to recycle it. And I believe at this stage, we don't have that. And then shift our mentality, maybe not so much from cars, but to other modes of transportation, which is public transport and bicycles, right? And that's something the cities in Europe are doing. And that's a definite way to shift our car dependency, which is they have this mental addiction to cars. I don't have a driving license, and I perfectly survive. And I think we can drive less for sure. And in Berlin, they're building highways for bicycles. I know that I've seen that. So that's it's an intricate for me. Cities need to take an integrated take at that. which is, well, technology on one hand, alternative ways to deal with transportation, and definitely bicycles. I just want to say that we do have these cities that are built around the car, no? Mm-hmm. And that's, and all the space the car takes, right? And we are somehow, you know, with all the bad, you know, the strategies of that, we have to shift our, it's always, resilience also a shift in the imagination. And I think that's something that we have to work at.
And this is a track that a lot of cities are taking. I mean, besides trying to encourage individual electric car use, using electric technologies for public transport and for sharing programs that are meant to reduce the total amount rather than just replace what's there with a version with other issues, let's say.
Yes.
From a pragmatic perspective. So I think you already make the case. I mean, from an ethical perspective, it seems obvious that we need to take a different tack. But you also mentioned the option of just putting on your blinkers and not looking at it. pragmatically, you know, we have these targets in cities we need to hit.
I was trying to be provocative.
Yeah.
Don't take me at face value. Okay.
We have these climate targets we need to hit and air pollution targets, and it's very convenient to just ignore certain issues. So are there also pragmatic reasons for city representatives, I'm talking about people working at the local level, to be aware of just resilience and trying to incorporate that in their strategies?
Oh, absolutely. We talk about resilience, we talk about climate change as this global threat that sometimes it's difficult to wrap our minds around it, but dealing with climate change and building just resilience is also a way to tackle other issues that cities are suffering from, which is contamination in general and health problems which come with this contamination, and also all the economic impacts that climate change has on the economies, which eventually impact the way we live our lives in the city. So cities are connected to agriculture, which is highly impacted by climate change, and we are also coastal societies to a great extent, and therefore the rise of sea levels is something that it's happening. It's not even a question of it's funny, because we used very a few years ago was to talk about future generations, right? And by the way, justice also deals with this idea of intergenerational justice, of how we are actually living, not only looking away from the injustice we create around the world, but also in a way very, very short term sight, in the sense that we think about ourselves and not future generations. But it's actually not about future generations anymore. We are that future generations, and we see the impacts of climate change all around the cities in the world, and this is, the effects are obvious. It's nice to see that cities are taking measures. This summer, early autumn, we went to Denmark in an International Water Association Congress, which is a major one every 2 years. And we took a field trip to cities which are dealing with, for instance, increased flooding and are taking measures to counter that. But also they are doing it in a way that is coherent with climate resilience principles, right? So instead of major infrastructural investments, which would shift the budget from other important priorities in the cities, for instance, they are implementing sustainable drainage systems, green infrastructure, they are making the streets more permeable, smaller, cheaper interventions, which can deal, for instance, with this with storm water in a way that does not, because what happens in cities is usually the storms, the way they the storms hit the cities, that you have a lot of water at the beginning, flush, they call it the fudge frost, which is extremely toxic, and the sewer system does not have the capacity to absorb that, which is the classical gray infrastructure. So it was beautiful to see this infiltration ponds and all around the city, perfectly integrated in that. And I know from speaking to the municipality that they are also taking into consideration how a storm increased flooding is impacting more vulnerable communities first. This also happens in Spain. I'm located in Spain, and you think of Spain as a dry place, but actually what happens is that we have very concentrated rain, and this happens a lot more due to climate change. And this does impact poorer racialized communities, which tend to be located in places that are more vulnerable to flooding. And then obviously this is something that from a pragmatic point of view, a city needs to deal with, because if you don't prevent it, then you will find it down the line in different ways. Now, these are, just examples of why it is important to deal with this. It will hit us down the way. It is happening right now, and therefore its adaptation is key.
What you're talking about now is the fact that climate change is something that we can't ignore, and that climate change that's exacerbated in one part of the world or is going to affect everyone. So I want to know why, when we're taking measures that do create adaptation or mitigation of climate change, why we have to also consider this element of justice. Just because a measure increases our resilience to climate change doesn't mean that it's necessarily one that we should take.
Nowadays we talk about nature-based solutions, but it's actually about increasing the amount of green in the cities, of creating green corridors, more parks, and in general bringing nature back into the city, which is a very pragmatic way to deal with the effects of climate change, because cities become refuges for heat waves, and it reduces the heat island effect. There's also more absorption of emissions, etc., etc. So in general, nature has a good, there's a positive effect on the communities without a doubt. Now, if these interventions are not considered in a wider perspective, take into consideration justice criteria, what can happen is that green interventions can also have negative effects. And one of them, and it's been studied a lot here by the Barcelona Lab for Environmental Justice, which is a very powerful group here in Catalonia. So my colleagues from there talk about green gentrification, which means that actually beautify nature is also something that we all want close to our homes. And therefore, what happens is that it increases the prices the real estate, and therefore it displaces communities which can no longer afford to live in those areas, and therefore you see how climate change intervention, something which is positive, can determine displacement and suffering. The question that one has to ask as a municipality is, who is this green for? Yes, I am. As a public servant, or as a municipality, let's say, to reify them a bit, is I have to look at these challenges in an integrated way. So yes, I have to deal with climate change. I have to deal with health effects created by climate change and the pollution in my city. But first of all, is this green equitably spread around the city? Do all the communities have an equal or similar access to green? And we know that in the United States, for example, there was this number that I remember, that was a black kid would have access to something around 3 acres or 5 acres of green, while a white child would have access to 96 acres of green. So this is where, so distribution of parks and access to green amenities is highly unequal. And at the same time, how these interventions can create more inequality in the city, because they are directed or can be enjoyed only by the rich, or create rent increases and prices in real estate. So what can the city do about it? Well, because we have to be pragmatic, right? In a way, we have examples here in Barcelona or in Nantes, where one way to deal with it is to put rent caps. But that's all. Sometimes it's complicated, because cities not always have the competence to deal with rent. Sometimes in Spain, this is a national competence, so they have to negotiate. It's a governance intricate question. Or inclusion of zoning, where you have real estate development in a part which has been greened and beautified, but at the same time you have to put a minimal inclusion of social housing in that part. So just I give you just a few examples there, because I think it is a green gentrification is a very good example of how greening and social considerations are not always compatible. And
if you'd allow me, just to reiterate the paradox that I think, as I understand what you're saying, you have kind of a double bind for cities, because on the one hand, you have the issue that a lot of green infrastructure may be built in richer or more privileged areas, and so there's going to be less access for poorer communities. But on the other hand, if you try to solve that problem by creating more parks and natural areas in poorer communities, you're going to find that their rent goes up and that they have to move out, basically. So the area is gentrified. So there seems to be a lose-lose situation as far as the vulnerable are concerned.
The rich win.
Oh yeah. Okay.
No, there's no doubt about that. So no, the problem is justice. It's again, it's a distributional issue. So again, we started by talking about distribution of goods and bads. So goods, access to green, nice things, are usually for those who can afford them, and also distribution of bads. Where are we shifting the burden of climate change, of our adaptation? Because where are these people relocated? They usually go, and this is, they usually go to places which are more exposed, so closer to landfills. This happens a lot, for example, in the United States. Actually, the environmental justice movement started because they realized that there was protest against the fact that the Black communities were located closer to landfills or toxic wastes. So this is something so you have these, there's our chain effects. The same for Romania. So we have this green development in a place that shifts usually Roma communities to landfills where they inhale toxic waste, etc. No, and that's something that cities need to take into consideration.
So far, in part one of this episode, Alexandra hasn't been shy about shining an uncomfortable light on the shadows that some of our popular best practices cast over our cities and the world. She pointed out that climate change disproportionately affects vulnerable groups, but that the measures we take to fight climate change, if we're not careful, can end up harming those people too. Even something as innocent as planting a tree could be contributing to pushing people out of their homes. You might have noticed that I kept pushing, perhaps for too long, to get a pragmatic rather than an ethical motivation for just resilience. To be honest, I had an answer in mind that I was hoping she'd produce. I think we get the pragmatic answer quite quickly if we ask ourselves why we're fighting climate change in the first place, to improve the quality of people's lives. If we keep this practical goal in mind rather than just the emissions targets that we've set ourselves, then it becomes obvious that measures to fight climate change that have a net harm on society are counterproductive. That's my pragmatic answer to why we should pursue not just resilience, but just resilience. In the second part of our conversation, Alexandra will supply another one. In the absence of justice, people will resist. I hope you enjoy part two of our conversation, where Alexandra will emphasize the importance of participatory processes, leave me speechless on the subject of over-tourism, crack open the gender dimension of just resilience, and even call into question capitalism and our growth-based economic model. Fasten your seatbelts.
Now I'm involved in Girona, in the University of Girona. It's a relatively small, 100,000 inhabitant city, beautiful, and they are now also now investing a lot. They have this grant to invest in renaturing the city with the climate change as a discourse to legitimate this greening, and everybody wants that. So it is no surprise. But it was, as I was writing the project, you really have to insist that you cannot just deal with greening from a purely technical point of view. That yes, if we have to do, and it's not only greening, it's because nature is not just green. It's a blue, what they call it, the blue-green intervention. So you have interventions that have to do with renaturing the cities need to take into consideration social aspects, and not only take them into consideration while you are writing the project and implementing it, but there is also these issues of participation that we have not discussed, because justice is not just distribution, it's also procedural justice. And recognitional, there's also this idea of recognitional and procedural justice. So the way you implement it, not just the effects that it produces, your intervention, but how you do it along the way, who is involved, who is given voice and decision-making power. Are these communities that are affected involved in the process of greening and making our cities more resilient? Are they included, or are they at the end of this interventions, you just have to, let's say, in a way, swallow this effect. And it is very likely that if communities were involved in many of these beautification policies in Barcelona, for instance, which is the city I live in, that many of them would not have been implemented, which is as you say, is a conundrum. You do want the cities to be more beautiful, but how do you do it? Well, one way to do it is to negotiate with those involved. By opening the process, making them more democratic, not only participatory.
Participatory processes are things that we're still learning about a lot, and often you see it framed as something that's really more intended, like the participation element is more intended to convince people than to co-create, say, or engage with them. Can you tell me a little bit about why it's so important to have truly participative or co-creative processes rather than, you might say, manipulative processes?
Yes. Participation is key, but it has also become a buzzword, if you will. Yeah, because there has been, I have been involved in several European projects, and I've noticed, for many years now, I've noticed how words like co-creation, participation have become part of the mainstream discourse of the European Union, for instance, and this is good on the one hand, but I've also noticed how the processes of participation are undertaken, to just say, I've done it in a participatory way. Yeah, I've involved the community at some point. And there's a lot of literature in urban planning that it has been, you know, widely studied why participatory processes don't work many times. And it is precisely because as a decision maker, you are also pressed by time, and you tend to think that if you the democracy is time consuming. And it is, actually. If one has been in an assembly of a neighborhood, you know how difficult it is to actually come take a decision. And therefore, the dilemma, the conundrum that public administrations have is to combine, to open the public decision, so that the decision-making process to the people, if you want, or to the society organized, and at the same time to keep the experts involved. And that is very difficult. And I've seen it. I'm myself involved in these processes too. The experts know it. They know how they have to go about. They have to implement this large infrastructure here, and they know it. And at the same time, the community would oppose it. And the politician is somewhere in between. Now, why is it important to insist on opening decision-making process to participation? It's also because you can have rejection to the measure. So you would want the communities to own those green interventions in the city. You wouldn't want, in some cases, you may not even want to implement that at all, right? I think it's an adequate example. In the 90s here, it's actually not so studied. In the 90s here, we had, they call it it was street wars against implementing a park in marginal neighborhoods of Barcelona, because people wanted something else. They wanted a school there instead of a park, just to give you an example. So you would think, yes, we want green interventions, but people may want other types of infrastructure that are more vital for those communities, and not a park, which would create, which they know Very well, we are discovering this in academia, but people know that if you clean up their street and put a park in the corner and some green alleys, people may want to live there, or you take out the traffic from an area. So making a pedestrian street that can have considerable rejection from those communities, which are probably middle class. For example, here near my house, I know that people are worried that taking out the traffic from an area and greening it will increase the rents. So how do you do that? Well, you have to talk to the people and involve them in the process to avoid at least part of the negative lack of acceptance, or simply accept that you cannot do that particular project.
You mentioned two practical things to counter those fears. One was rent caps, which aren't always possible at the local level. And the other one was zoning for social housing being part of the process. Are there any other avenues that cities can take to counter gentrification that accompanies these greening policies?
Well, for instance, in Barcelona, it's a case that I know better. Gentrification goes hand in hand with touristification, which means that a lot of the real estate is being bought by entered into agreements to become tourist lodging, and the new the government in Barcelona is a left-wing one. Now they are at the end of their second term, and they have this war against tourism, if you want, because Barcelona is this very touristical city. Everybody wants to visit, and this is good because it brings a lot for the economy. But at the same time, well, we have all these issues that real estate has become unaffordable. So one way to deal with it is to limit the amount of permits for tourist lodging in areas which are already in the process of let's say touristification and gentrification, because it goes along. The other way is to incentivize or to promote the local communities' activities, which would, and at the same time, which would make people want to, let's say, hold on to those places and to create, let's say, a vibrant community there. But it usually has to do with taxation, and it has to do with permits, which is, for instance, for tourist flats, so they say they are measures that are part of the competencies of the municipalities. Because other issues, again, rent caps, for instance, I think in Paris, in France, they have tried, they are doing this, but it is very difficult because they have to negotiate with the central government. But I don't want to be caught red-handed by by an expert in France gentrification. What I know for sure is that that rent caps are a way to go about. But they do not always depend on the...
I think I've seen a lot of cities that are launching programs to just make sure that the gains from tourism are more equitably distributed. For example, that local communities are enabled to become economic actors that can benefit from tourism, or that local cultural practices are integrated into tourist strategies so that they can be bolstered by tourism rather than... Exactly. Well, co-opted would be one way of putting it, yeah.
It's true. It's true. And we haven't actually, one thing that we haven't discussed, because we talk about, because we discussed a lot about, let's say, classes, the disparities, so it's a low income communities which can be badly affected, but there are other groups like race and gender, and say women. We know that women make a particular use of the public space, and that needs which is different, and you need data, segregated data, to understand that before you do a public intervention into greening and to building resilience, if you want, and this is these are also issues that have been studied a lot. And when a city decides or to put together a plan for adaptation for climate change, all these issues need to be taken into consideration. And it's about opening your eyes, about being aware that greening impacts justice, and not only greening, but in general, environmental interventions need to be taken together with an approach that deal with gender, with race, and with income. Otherwise, you may have this, well, let's say, these issues.
Gender is a particularly interesting one because it is so complex. I think with the richer and poorer, or also unfortunately racially, you're often looking at geographic divides within a city. Yes. Whereas when it comes to gender, you're not talking about people that are in different parts of the city, usually. Right?
Where? Everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. So can you tell us a little bit more about how greening can have specifically a gendered effect? And if you know of any examples of how cities are trying to incorporate this very, very complex topic into their strategies?
Well, Barcelona is my backyard, so that's why I know it better. There is this concept of ecofeminism, which acknowledges that actually the environment and gender are highly dependent issues. It is translated in the fact that women tend to have different access to information, to training. Risk perception is different, and therefore the gender roles are clearly differentiated, and therefore you would know that the way women make use of the public space is different because they are vulnerable in a way, because they tend to carry the burden of care, caring for children, and therefore they need a specific space for that. So streets need to be designed in that way. Also, the night use of the city is different. The way resources are distributed is also impacting their lives more, and therefore the women tend to suffer more from the impacts of climate change. So there are inequalities in power, in participation, in decision making. Yeah, I didn't want to slide too much into discussions on capitalism and how capitalism actually tends to be very dependent on, let's say, patriarchal systems, which exploit women more. And therefore, it's normal that the need of capitalists for cheap labor and for free care is something that has to do with gender intimately. So I think it's a big discussion, but what I would definitely recommend is that decision makers take that issue into consideration and not avoid it, because there's so much literature done on this, and therefore just take it into consideration. That's it. That's
is there anything that's been done in Barcelona or other cities you're aware of that has sort of, in your opinion, successfully taken this gender question into account?
Yes, I mean, we have here located one of the, for me, one of the most innovative planning collectives in Barcelona. It's called the Collective Point Six, which is specialized specifically on gender issues. And I would recommend those who are interested in these issues to look at how they are taking women into consideration when it comes to planning. First of all, the most important part in the planning phase to take women into consideration is in the sense of seeing how they use the public space in a differential way, right? For instance, when you're building, one of the things that there is when you're building climate refuge, consider women differently. I think Barcelona in this sense is a good example.
Refuge centers, that's when you're doing adaptation and you want to, for example, have heat shelters in winter or ventilated shelters during the summer to make sure that those are well designed for both genders.
Yes, that would be genders. Yes, for all gender. Yeah, that's actually, this is one of the issues that I was because we are now so we're still tributary to the two gender mentality, to the binary way, and actually, as I was reading one of these studies, they were talking about the difficulty actually of approaching integrating a more open a way of dealing with gender. So you say, how do you approach women? How do you approach gender surveys when you have to say, because you have to approach people that appear in a certain way, but then, so there is an intricacy in trying to not, for example, misgender people when you are doing this survey. So that's another thing that one has to take into consideration. But the bottom line is that inequality and gender are intimately related, and therefore climate change will impact women more because they are already more vulnerable, and that's something that one has to take into account.
Something that we use to adapt to climate change and something that notifies us of the issues with climate change is water. And you've written about this issue of just resilience in relation to water and data and distributed networks.
Yeah, I think water is a key. Let's say it's a very good story for climate resilience, because it's in our imaginary, it's also a primary. We think of a climate disaster, we think of water immediately. This is water, drought, heat, but also extreme weather events, which involve flooding. And when we look at the urban level and the urban water system, we can think of, for instance, the drinking water supply, like for the different water systems that are, let's say, need to be considered within at the city level. The drinking water system can be impacted in terms of availability. Yes, so you have on the one hand more water because of extreme weather events, but at the same time, there's also water scarcity, which heavily impacts depending on which parts of the world. So what in Spain, we know this very well. So we suffer from both evils, both stormwater extreme and also drinking water scarcity. Again, at the city level, it's about drinking water. And one way to deal with it is to increase the supply. It's a very typical neoliberal, if you want, way to imagine that resources are endless. So what we have to do is to bring in more technology. For example, desalination plants are one way. So major infrastructures that will feed our system, permanently thirsty systems, right? But not only have to thrive, but they have to grow. And we haven't discussed growth as a, let's say, as a primary driver of climate change. This need for our society to expand and expand. And in order to expand, urbanization, for example, the cities need to expand and grow and become, let's say, to develop, they need water as a primary nutrient. One way to deal with it, again, is by bringing more water into the system, by bringing, let's say, mobilizing the sea. But another way, which is more just, if you want, which does not put more pressure on energy systems, because desalination is highly costly in terms of energy, and that is the main problem, is to deal with demand. And to try to think in behavioral terms that we can, maybe we should stop imagining this, that water is infinite and all we need is to bring more water into the system, no matter the energy cost. But then we have seen that this cost eventually, it is paid somehow. It is shifted. If it's not paid, then it is shifted. If we go to let's say renewable energy, we see that the cost of this, the negative externalities, will eventually impact us. And if it's not us, it's others somewhere far away and out of sight. And in this sense, demand management is a way to go about. Related to storm water management, we have discussed this. So cities tend to be, storm events tend to affect more the vulnerable. And in order to, and it is better and more just to try to have some interventions that are small size, that permeabilize the cities, and also that try to compensate those communities which are more impacted than others, either relocating or trying to, but relocated in a way that is conscious and aware and sensitive to their needs, and also try to see whether those whether new communities are in floodplains, for instance. Usually there are poor communities, so trying to avoid that. The water and the way we manage water is indicative of the way we deal with justice and development in general. We have to think that that what is inbuilt in the notion of resilience is that we have to take whatever is thrown to us and just become more resilient. While if you want from a degrowth perspective, from a perspective that questions the very basics of our economic model, of our capitalist economic model, which needs, on the one hand, more and more, is addicted to growth and needs to grow every time more, which is a completely absurd notion, if you want, this impossibility of infinite growth, which shifts burden to more vulnerable communities and also extracts, with all the pain that this entails, their resources to keep feeding the beast. And we are talking from the belly of the beast, from the Western Europe, right? So it's so we have to question this model. And I think what's interesting about the notion of degrowth is that, well, it is not about becoming more resilient and entrenching ourselves in our model, but maybe becoming more resilient means to open up this model and think about alternative ways, alternative economies, ones that are happier in a way with less, right? Because we think of growth, but growth for whom? No, and growth for what? Are we happier necessarily by this material accumulation? So these are philosophical questions, or if you want, but that they are intimately related to the idea of justice and to resilience. We need to redefine. So not to redefine, well, to redefine, but first of all, to question when we are told to become more resilient, does this mean that we have to perpetuate a system that is intrinsically unsustainable, or can we open ourselves as cities and as citizens to other models of development? Yeah, give us a real chance, which does not preclude technological development. Why not? We need to treat our water better. We need to find ways to, you know, supply energy, but not to feed into the same system that has brought us to the brink of disaster. And we are just trying to greenwash and make it more circular. By the way, circular economy is one way that that is a beautiful concept. But is it possible for an economy which is so big and so wasteful to all of a sudden become circular? So our question.
So now you start to get radical. I have to close you off immediately and make sure
exactly. That no one hears this. Shut me down.
I think for me the main message I got is just being aware of these issues in your planning, making sure that there is consultation and participation in these processes as they're going on. I think those are the two key messages I've had from you in terms of how to integrate just resilience practically into policy planning for sustainable cities. Would you agree with that characterization?
So I agree. And if you want to take home messages that you cannot separate in planning, because it is in reality not separated, the idea of environmental intervention with social impacts and social implications of our becoming more resilient to climate change, even and in this sense participatory approaches are important but are not sufficient, because they also have to be done in ways that are actually giving voices to those community. And that's not easy, because sometimes you have to really go to engage with communities that are not informed, that are they may not want to participate in the first place or don't know that this is important for them. So we really have to approach them in a way that is effective and truly democratic. So really separating the idea of democracy from participation, just mere participation, placating and putting it as a almost as a bureaucratic, because we will find the effects of this down the line. We will have to deal with protest and unacceptance. And so it's in a way politicizing, making political, which involves assuming that, so, you know, integrating also protest and opposition into this process to make it more democratic and not just participatory, to make sure that I'm coming to that we're going to get to the same results anyway, but with some participation, okay? And it is a pragmatic one.
Is there something special about the local level?
Well, the majority of population is concentrated in cities and will be, this trend is growing. We're going to face that increase in urban population, and therefore cities are not only the places for challenges but also for opportunities, because they have this closer connection to the local communities. Sometimes the problem is that they don't always have the means and the competencies. So it is in the governance schemes, they are not provided with financing, and we've seen that austerity in Spain at least has hit especially the cities more because of the way the financial system is organized. So they are burdened in a way with they are in the first line. But at the same time, they don't always have the capacity to react, but they are in the first line. So I'd say.
If people want to learn more about these issues or follow your work, is there anything that you would recommend to them?
I would recommend to follow my group, Lekia, at the University of Girona. We are doing a lot of interesting work, I think, and we are trying to follow these principles in practice and trying to stretch the limits of environmental interventions and research to become more interdisciplinary, more wary of our moral, of our positionality, if you want, and of the importance of social and political aspects. I have to insist on the political aspects in environmental interventions in general. So go to Lekia.
That's L-E-K-I-A?
Yes, L-E-K-U-I-A. Lekia would be. Okay. The name at the University of Girona. We have a group on social natural system which tries to bring together a wide area of practitioners too, and I try to practice what we preach.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for joining me for this second Covenant of Mayors podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find a full transcript of this episode on the Covenant of Mayors website, as well as our first episode and future episodes to come. See you next time.